little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics, and my name is Bob Frelick, and my voice is coming in remotely by Skype, and with me remotely is Thinking Clearly co-host Julia Minton.
Hi, Bob. Hello, listening audience. I am sheltered in my place, joining you here via Skype on KMUD.
Well, you know, if we coax her nicely, Julia might tell us something about how to get in touch with us here at Thinking Clearly.
Coaxing nicely, I'll take it. That's, you know, it's a nice change of pace these days. So as I like to say, Bob and I are real people, and we love hearing from you, our listening audience. In fact, listeners have given us a number of ideas for topics over the years now. And of course, we are also podcasting the show. Once it's complete, it goes up usually the next day. And you can find us really in just about any of your podcast apps. Open up your podcast app, search for podcasts, put in Thinking Clearly, and we should come right up. However, you can also visit thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. That's Libsyn, like L-I-B-S-Y-N, Liberated Syndication.com. And you can find our entire archive of podcasts there. And then, of course, I guess I would be remiss to forget that we are on Facebook, like many things in this world. Again, just type in Thinking Clearly, and you'll find our Facebook page there, where our future shows are often promoted, and the podcast is posted as well.
Excellent. I'm going to give a quote that'll connect to tonight's episode. It goes like this: don't jump in with 2 feet where truly informed people tread with care. And this is a quote from the author of the book titled A Rule Book for Arguments, who is our guest on this episode of Thinking Clearly. Julia, how would you frame the topic for this episode?
Well, critical thinking, of course.
Yeah. And it's sort of best practices in critical thinking, tips from a longtime teacher of critical thinking. And our guest for this edition of Thinking Clearly is Anthony Weston. He's got a PhD in philosophy and began his teaching career at State University of New York at Stony Brook, where he spent about 10 years before moving to Elon University in North Carolina. And then after a 26-year tenure at Elon, in 2018, he retired as a full professor in both the Department of Philosophy and Department of Environmental Studies. And his retirement allowed him to continue developing his long-time vision of collaboratively creating Hart's Mill Eco-Village. And in its mission statement, quote, an agrarian intentional community that is regenerative, collaborative, creative, and celebratory in all that we do. Sounds wonderful. Anthony Weston has a long and deep connection with critical thinking and has taught and extensively written on the subject, including the books A Rule Book for Arguments and another book called A Workbook for Arguments, and his latest, which is titled Thinking Through Questions, A Concise Invitation to Critical, Expansive, and Philosophic Inquiry. Anthony, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
You're in a beautiful part of the world, and I think we'll get a chance to talk about that a little later, but I think Julia's got a question for you.
May I say one thing first, though? Just I have to, it's sort of an apology, sort of an explanation. So I'm also sheltering in place. And one feature of that is that I'm out on my porch because my house is full with my kids and their friends and partners and everything. So the effect, which is actually pretty nice overall, but the one effect of it is there are a number of frogs croaking. So if you hear background, it's occasionally an owl and occasionally sirens. So any of that sound that you might be hearing is just sort of background here. It's actually, I find, kind of delightful. But just so you're wondering, like, where are frogs in this store? Where are the frogs coming from, or the owls or something? That's me and my background here on my porch.
Well, we live in nature, too, so we'll be delighted to hear that.
Oh, great.
Yeah, sounds delightful. I've got some baby birds outside my window as well. But thanks so much for joining us tonight, Anthony. I guess I'll start with our first question. So you retired from Elon University in 2018 after a long teaching and research career there. and before that at SUNY. When in your teaching career did you start teaching critical thinking classes, and what prompted you to have an interest in doing that?
Well, from the beginning, actually, even before I was teaching in graduate school at University of Michigan and mostly teaching critical thinking, or what in those days, and at least philosophy, is called informal logic. But pretty quickly, people realized that it wasn't just a watered-down version of formal logic, but was a completely different thing, which I am one of the projects of the rulebook actually was to make that very evident, to offer a way to teach, because that was the first thing I wrote. It was in the 80s, and I guess I should say 1980s for younger folks. Anyway, it was at that time, philosophers still really did think that real story about how to think was formal logic, and this other stuff was kind of not really as good, but you sort of had to do it because more people were interested in that than in formal logic. But in my view, all the action, the really interesting action, the powerful kinds of thinking, and also the need for a lot of care was on the side of how do you generalize to generalizations from a few examples, or how do you know how to evaluate appeals to authority and data and research, and think about causes and all of that. So to me, from the start, that was the most important thing. I'll say, so how did I get interested in all that? Well, I was a child of the 60s, that is 1960s. and people were a little bit like now, but people were, it was more of a surprise to learn that you maybe had to mistrust your government. This is Vietnam, remember, and the Nixon years, that, things were not as they seemed, perhaps. And so that was, and it was also a time of imagination. Things could be different. How do you think about how things could be different? And so all those things really made for a really rich and challenging kind of, critical thinking. Then I went to college, and I was on the debate team, which was all of the, fairly strictly defined in terms of the structures of arguments and exchanges, and who made what speeches in the debate rounds. But it was, it was so energizing and very fast, and everything had to be kind of instantly ready. Tremendously exciting, a lot of adrenaline and coffee and things for me. And I didn't stay with that all of college because I eventually was doing more philosophy and other things. But the experience was so powerful that when I started teaching critical thinking, it basically was on a debate kind of model, really teaching people how to figure out arguments, quickly structure them, respond, know what the kinds of categories are, would be for responding to them, and so on. And gradually it evolved into other things. But it started with that, really trying to capture for my students that same energy I found in college debate.
I don't think we've, on Thinking Clearly, really talked about the difference between formal logic and informal logic. Is it fair to say that informal logic is sort of better adapted to talking about real life issues?
Yeah, well, so technically or officially, formal logic is the formalizable systems of deduction. So either propositional logic, which is like the famous if P then Q, not Q therefore not P kind of stuff, or what's called predicate logic, where you can get inside the structure of propositions, and there are sentences like, if for all X, if X is A, that X is B, and that kind of stuff, which is useful in its way, but not really very much for the kinds of arguments I was mentioning before we generally deal with. Like, for example, when you run across the internet some claim or other, or let's say read it on Wikipedia, how do you know whether that's true or not? There actually are answers to that, right? Well, at least there are better and worse ways of going at that. But that's not dealt with at all by formalized systems of, being able to formalize a propositional logic isn't going to help you with that, right? Or thinking about causes and statistical arguments, what is certain, A is associated with B, like, violence is associated, there's more violence on TV. So how do you, does that mean that, and it's associated with a more violent society. So what's happening? Is violence on TV causing the violence in society? Is it the other way around? Are they not related? Is something else causing both of them? Those kinds of things are what would have been called then informal logic. Mm-hmm. So yeah, real life. But they're not, these days people don't talk that way particularly. It was kind of in my view, kind of passing phase in philosophy as philosophers got used to the idea that the real action was not in logic, not in formal logic.
If I calculated it right, you started at Elon in about 1982, is that right?
Oh, 92. 82 is my PhD. I was at Stony Brook until the early 90s.
Okay, so it was 92. So that was really after the big push here in the Cal States in California to implement critical thinking as a graduation requirement, mm-hmm. part of their general ed, their breadth requirements. And that was in, I think, 1983. Mm-hmm. So did they have that when you started at Elon?
No, it was never mandatory. Actually, what at least from a philosopher's point of view, the impetus for that didn't come out of, well, it depended on the university. It often it came out of some like English or public speaking or rhetorical writing uh-huh. or things like that, where it was not how to say this doesn't. I don't mean this in a critical way, but it wasn't really about the uses of evidence so much as how do you structure an argument and carry on rhetorically, not in a problematic sense necessarily, but you know the language of argument and the structure of debate and that kind of stuff. So that wasn't necessarily part of philosophy. But philosophers, I think, have collaboratively with, you know, these other fields like rhetoric and public speaking and English to some extent. Philosophers, so it's now been a kind of collaborative project to really figure out what the, well, I guess in a certain way I have, my view is that, you know, you could spend an entire college career just learning that, right? The problem mm-hmm. is, of course, there are lots of other things to learn. So it's just one course oftentimes. So the real question is, what do you put in the course? So many things you could do. How do you boil it down and give students the biggest, you know, the biggest benefit for the time that they have? So that's the sort of thing that's evolved since then, I think.
Perhaps it would be fair to say that it's like an applied logic.
Yeah, it's the applied logical frame of mind, I think, because you're trying to figure out the structure of the thought and you're trying to evaluate it. Technically, it's not applied because it's not very little of it is applied deduction, which is what the formal logic would be. Usually, it's more
true.
Well, philosophers will distinguish deduction from induction, which is really just another category I don't like very much. But it's kind of a grab bag category for all kinds of reasoning that aren't deduction. My own view is it's more useful to think of them as separate, more or less separate categories. So things like how do you generalize from a few examples? Well, there are rules for that. You can't be sure. One thing about deduction, that's why philosophers like it so much, is you can be sure. If you have true premises, then if you put them in a deductive form and you have a valid conclusion, then you have a true conclusion. The problem is, you know, in that case, so great if you have true premises, but then you're back to where you started. How do you know that, right? At some point, it's got to be about the actual world, which is uncertain and which we never know perfectly, and which we're always, you know, working from best guesses careful hypothesizing or not careful hypothesizing, whatever it is. So that's the world we're working in. Yeah, but it's true. It's the applied attitude of logic, which is it's hard to know things, but possible with a lot of thoughtfulness and caution and modesty and system and time and patience and sometimes imagination, but you know it takes work and it takes there are steps to take. It's not just a matter of okay, this is what I believe. This figuring things out, that's a life's work too, you know, even for a very particular question.
I think Bob said something before about like critical thinking being an attitude. It's the first time I've heard logic being referred to that way. It really kind of makes sense.
That's what philosophers used to teach formal logic to legions of undergraduates for no particular reason, because it wasn't really helpful for any of their thinking or very little of it, except for the logical attitude or, you know, whatever they might get by more or less osmosis in many cases, but just how do you think when you're being as systematic and rigorous as possible? So it's like, I don't know what that would be like teaching geometry in high school. At least when I was in high school, that's what we learned. But very few people became surveyors, right? But there was that idea of like deductions from first principles. That for a lot of people, there's almost an aesthetic to it. That's a really exciting and beautiful, wonderful thing that you wouldn't have guessed at if you're a teenager, right? You have to, at least then, you know, now maybe I suppose you could think of computer programming as a little bit like that. It has a logical structure. It's not forgiving. it's clear when it works and when it doesn't work. And it can be a beautiful thing in that sort of abstract way, I guess. But at the time, it was basically logic. A lot of courses, actually, even in every school I've been at, there's been a migration out of formal logic into programming, because for that very reason.
Oh, how interesting. We're talking about, you know, learning logic and critical thinking. You as a teacher, what would you say is, you know, some of the important aspects in teaching critical thinking to other people?
Practice. practice. Because this attitude that we're talking about, that kind of gets you into the ballpark, but ultimately it's something you have to do, and you have to do all the time. And I suppose another way to say it is it's a way of life to think carefully and openly about things all the time. So that's, to me, the overriding thing. There are many aspects to it. There are many kinds of argument and inference going on, and from, you know, systematic scientific research to making sense of your daughters or parents or whatever. All that's happening, but to continuously try to think it through carefully and openly, that's always, it's a challenge, and it's a way of life. So to me, the most important thing is the consistency of practice. So really, it's like, to me, I think of the critical thinking teaching as, it's like, I'm also a musician, and I occasionally taught music, but it's always, you know, these are not courses in music theory. They're courses in music where you play and you sing and you do stuff together and you hear it and you know, learn to move together better and learn to tune and learn all those things. So to me, it's conveying that attitude and just being immersed in it all the time is the key thing.
Unfortunately, we've recently gotten very far away from that attitude.
Well, that's very true.
Our political discourse. And another part of this that's related is that you've done a lot of thinking and writing about ethics, too, in your career. And many, if not most, of the real-life issues have a part of them that involve values-based ethical or moral questions and claims. And admittedly, this was a revelation to me. Before I started this program, I hadn't really thought about the difference between the way the world is or the way the world should be, or we'd like the world to be, values-based versus more objective considerations. So ethic and moral argumentation and thinking is a whole different bag of tricks. So, I mean, there are full courses on that, many full courses, if you're taking this formally, philosophy. But without taking a full course, which most of our listeners are not going to be doing, on moral reasoning, how can folks really best identify and critically think about values-based issues?
Yeah, great questions. I think the first thing I would recommend, it's kind of in line with this idea of attitude and way of life and making a project of it, a consistent project of it, is being explicit. By that I mean trying to state what the basic values are. It doesn't, not quite principle as in people should do X or Y or something, but just like what's at stake. So it may be more than one thing. In fact, it's almost always in any kind of troublesome moral issue, it is more than one thing, I think. It's what makes it a troublesome issue. So we say life is a value, and that can mean various things in different debates, but let's just say in general, life is good. We think of what kind of life? Well, depends on the issue again, but if we're talking about, let's say, environmental matters, we're thinking about not just human life, but other creatures and the living world in general. So say that, figure it out for yourself, which takes some work sometimes. You know, we think we take some work usually. We think we know about what we think about some issue, but it's usually a judgment about what should happen in a particular case, like this law should be passed or it shouldn't be passed, or people should do this or that, but not really what the fundamental values are. But the next thought is, there are probably more than one, I said before, because if it's a real moral issue, it isn't an issue between the obviously right and the obviously wrong, because in that case it wouldn't be an issue, right? It's an issue because there are multiple things that are good. That's the nature of life, seems to me. There are multiple things that are good, and we're trying to make some kind of integrated way forward with all of them, or some balance between them, or something like that. So that's the next big thing, is try to think about it as a balancing project, not as a somebody's right and everybody else is wrong, but we're all right in our ways. How do we work? How do we go on together? We don't have to say we just have to go one way or the other. We can oftentimes integrate and balance and carry forward with more than one basic value. So again, that to me is the, and that's beyond, you know, all this. If you take an ethics class, you learn a lot of history of ethics and various theories and puzzling dilemmas and things like that, and all that's fine. But your question was, what if you didn't have the course? And I said, well, then in that case, it's these attitudes, like looking for basic values, knowing that they're there, knowing that they're more than one, being willing to live with, well, it's conflict, but it's really just coexistence and you know, tension, but potentially resolvable tension between multiple things that matter. That's the main thing, being careful about it, being explicit, listening to other people who might have probably the same values, but maybe weigh them differently. Like you say, that's not exactly the norm at the present time. That's why we have a lot to learn, right? This is, I think, the core attitude of how critical thinking might, and you know, constructive thinking might take place in ethics.
And back in the day, there was a trend in schools to get into values clarification courses. In other words, how do we come up with our values? Do they get passed on by our parents? Have we really thought about them? And I don't know how much in vogue that is anymore, but I thought that was a very important part of any kind of learning, is to question your values, to try to figure out what is the source of my values and why do I believe that.
That language is not in vogue anymore, but that kind of project could be in some places. I guess I had the one piece of that I resist a little, is the idea that, well, this is true of clearer thinking too, actually, is that there tends to be a bit static. That is, the idea is that, you know, I know I have values, I need to figure out what they are, and that's sort of the end of the story, whereas it really it's more like the beginning of the story. But you said it very well, I think it was, although it wasn't so much a part of values clarification as officially, as I understood it, to really question your values is more to figure out what they were. But if figuring out what you might think about something is a good first step, but then you might learn, you know, like most of the time if we're open to learning, it can be very transformative, thinking about values in a more open-ended way. So I'm all for that, except to not kind of nail it down and think I'm just going to figure out what flags I want to nail to my mast. And don't use nails. definitely stand for things, but be open-minded at the same time, willing to move, willing to listen. We have work to do, I admit it. This is not, because I know you're going to say, well, that's not exactly what's happening at the present time. Well, that's true, but that's why we have work to do.
Yeah, and not to dwell on the values and ethical, moral questions too much, but I'm wondering whether in your courses that you taught that you were able, whether students actually had difficulty seeing the difference between is and ought questions in arguments.
Well, as you said before, they're basically oughts are almost always there. It's kind of funny. People make this point about formal logic, even as if you've studied formal logic, one of the things that you talk about all the time is truth value. It's a value, truth. And so even formal logic is evaluative, if you want to credit that far, at least. So for the most of the time, there are values in play. Oftentimes, they're implicit and shared and aren't necessarily the central focus. But sometimes, you're right, they are. So, just keeping that in focus. I never was so wild about kind of saying this setting up two categories and saying things are clearly in one or the other. It's most of the time they're both, in my view. The world is more complicated than I thought it was when I was 20. I hope that's true for most people. So I don't know. You know, most of what we call facts have some value component.
Yeah,
we can talk more about that if you want, I think. And most of what we call values have
a whole set
of beliefs about facts, about how the world is and all that.
Capturing your experience, long experience as a teacher of critical thinking, what aspects of critical thinking did you find most difficult for students to master?
Patience. Patience. You know, because there's such an insistence, and we're circling around the whole question of where the culture is, but just now, but in general, but such an insistence on having an answer, you know, or if you don't have an answer, like right off the top of your head, then having an answer really fast and having an answer that's reliable enough that you can like take it out and nail it to your mast, as it were. The idea that it might take time, that it might be unclear, that it might change, those are the hard things. Those were the really hard things for people to get. So it wasn't so, I mean, sure, there are certain skills that are more difficult than others, like figuring out how to, usually I would teach some method or other for diagramming the structure of complex arguments where there are multiple pieces of evidence and inferences in play and all that. So that was really useful stuff, I thought, and part of this attitude of thinking logically about the structure of thought and argument, well, you know, moving from evidence to conclusions. But that's a specific skill. It was hard to learn, but it's still a specific skill. But the really hard thing, it was this kind of patience and this attitude of openness. And that was something that I as a teacher could just model, you know, just being in the midst of the practice. I think of it like, well, I was saying like making music or swimming is another one. So I'm the swimming instructor, but I'm not standing on the edge of the pool yelling at people. I'm in the water. And they're seeing how I deal with it. And we work stuff out together like that. So it's very much a practice oriented, workshoppy kind of thing. And that, to me, that's the only way you can teach that sort of attitude, is by exemplifying it. So that was the hardest thing always. And I didn't care so much if students had, you know, what exact skills they had coming out in terms of the more detailed things. But boy, I wanted them to have a different attitude toward how do you think, like the basic kind of openness and wonder at all of it, and the willingness to jump in, like in a pool again. You know, here I'm swimming again, but boy, is it fun! And I'm learning something, I'm getting somewhere at the same time.
And that's where the practice comes in.
Totally, yeah. It's a skills course. It's like music. Music theory is wonderful and great, but it's theory, and you're not making music. So if people come to, you know, critical thinking classes to think, not to get lectured on about, you know, structure of logic, but to use it, you know, and to get it in their bones and to be out there in practice.
Yeah, I feel compelled to ask. Bob and I have certainly talked a bit on this radio show about how critical thinking is often, it's work. It's something you actively have to be doing. And, you know, like you said, practice, it gets easier and it becomes more of like a default, you know. But what advice would you have for people who, you know, say, oh, well, I like critical thinking, but it's just so exhausting, all of this patience and practice and work. What advice or approach would you give to people who are, you know, kind of concerned about that, the energy?
Well, on one level, I don't know about explicit advice, but it kind of goes back to what I was saying about my teaching practice, which is just to exemplify the joy. You know, like it really is. For me, it's such an enjoyable and liberating and imaginative thing to be doing this kind of, well, it's work, but it's, you know, all wonderful things. Just about all wonderful things are work in some way or other. But work doesn't have to be bad. It's like, it's a mode of self-expression and discovery and all that. So you know, part of the answer is just to do it with people without trying to tell them how good it is. Just show them, right? But but sometimes to be a little more explicit, you could try to focus on the parts of it that are really enjoyable. And so it could be, if you're really interested, you know, people are interested in different things. Maybe it's really exploring an issue in depth, you know. Or maybe it's practicing discernment, kind of going in. That's like depth. Like, I'm thinking of something like Wikipedia. I know you had a program on Wikipedia, which I found really interesting. I'm actually a big fan of Wikipedia. And one of the aspects of it that I find so enjoyable is all the layers to it. So, you know, there's the article, but then there's the whole history of the construction of the article and every single edit and revision that's ever been made in the whole history of it, which is accessible but with one click, right? And then there's, if you wanted to pursue that farther, there's a discussion, or usually there's the talk tab, or maybe you don't know, but people don't, listeners may not know that, but there's a talk tab on all those pages, and you can go in, and the editors, people who have made changes, can talk about why they made the changes and argue about them and, really get into all of that. If you wanted to, you could get involved yourself, because it's editable by anybody with not too much, not a very steep learning curve. So that's really enjoyable for a lot of people. And I find, so with my students, for example, one of the things that we would do is we would spend a fair amount of time on Wikipedia, and we would also, we started out writing pages that we would contribute, but later on it became a little more manageable to make revisions of parts of articles. It depended on the student's interest. All of which, by the way, I mediated, so they weren't doing it directly. That didn't seem fair to Wikipedia and editors to have students doing that right off, but it would go through me. But still, students got tremendously involved with it, and they were so proud and happy. Actually, we used to have launch parties when our edits went live. We'd have a party, and they would call their parents, and it was really kind of a lovely thing, because all their lives, for most students, they'd used it, but they never thought that they could contribute to it, and to realize that it is a common resource and that they actually had things that they could contribute that other people didn't know, that they could make this familiar and important and massive thing a little bit better by what they did, was a lovely thing for them. So that's a long way around of saying find the joy in it. Find the places where it isn't just drudgery or like, oh my God, like I have to be skeptical of everything. Well, that's useful too sometimes, but there are lots of parts of it that are really very fulfilling and very, very exciting.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. I think that actually makes a lot of sense, and that sort of that joy and celebration. And it certainly speaks to me, because I happen to think editing Wikipedia is a lot of fun, but that's me. And we touched on this a little bit earlier. Give us your thoughts on why, in this day and age and in this just incredible time that we're living in, that they call 2020, why critical thinking is important for us to learn and practice.
I'll answer that. I want to back up just a sec to talk about another example of excitement and joy, but this, it really is an answer to what you just asked as well, which is the other piece. So there's a long backstory, but just very briefly, I think imagination is an underestimated part of critical thinking. By that I mean something like when we imagine how things could be other than they are, we're really looking at, I mentioned I was a child of the 60s, this part of that is that there was a moment when people said, we wouldn't have to live this way, we could live other ways. And people experimented with that, and with their lives, and or at least in their imaginations and in art and other things, figure out how things could be different and radically better, not just a little better, but radically better. But it's critical thinking, because then when you think that way, you're also always thinking about how things are. You're going, how could they be better? And why aren't they better? And what can I do to make them better? So that's a form of critical engagement, but it's driven by something other than despair or cynicism or skepticism or something. It's driven by this real hopefulness and a wish to contribute. So now about right now? It's the same thing. I think, there's obviously things that are burdens and things that have to be dealt with, and the virus of COVID and the virus of racism. But, you know, the genius of, let's talk about racism and the situation of black folks right now, you know, the genius of the civil rights movement that we look back toward for inspiration is that it wasn't just reactive. You know, there was always this ideal of how things could be instead. And what the actual ideals were that so Dr. King is always talking about, like, what is America about anyway, when it's really living up to its ideals? What are those ideals? Equality and justice for all and all this. The dream that he didn't say, I have a nightmare that we'll never have equality. He said, I have a dream that we will have equality, right? So, but that was critical thinking at the same time, because obviously we didn't have it and we still don't have it. But the work, the energy, the passion is driven by an ideal of something positive. So that seems to me to be a really critical piece of, a really important piece of critical thinking. But it is not usually highlighted when we think about critical thinking as being more reactive and negative. So, but it's also tremendously engaging, to your question before last. How do you get people involved with this? So people want to think about how things could be better, right? So working with that, I think, is a real opening. And right now we need it, right? I mean, so we don't just want to, there is this part of the power of the moment, we're getting into politics here, but it seems to me is we don't just, we oughtn't, and I don't think for the most part we do want to just say, well, let's just go back to normal. Let's talk about COVID at the moment. But so many things, so many possibilities opened up in the space of the last 4 months, you know, like tremendous mobilization in ways that wouldn't have been dreamed of before. And well, that's interesting. We could do that, huh? So maybe we should do it about other things. What about the climate problems? And so, you know, the capacity of society to respond is suddenly much more evident. And, you know, there are lots of other things like that that could be pointed out. So I think that the moment can be taken up in a very, very positive way that involves critical thinking in a very central way.
I have two of your books, one that you co-authored, it's called A Workbook for Arguments, and then your latest, Thinking Through Questions. And I want to tell you why I like both of them. I like the workbook.
Oh, great. I love that. Yes. Okay.
I love the workbook because we talked about practice. It gives a lot of examples in that, and it gives users a wide variety of things to practice critical thinking on. And I think that part of, besides liking to do it, is getting in the habit of doing it. And that book, I use it in my spare time to go through various arguments, great. And you model different responses. It's great. I really love it. And I like the book Questions because I've never read or even seen a book about the art of questioning that covered both abuse and the use of questions. So can you just briefly talk about what your target audience was for those books?
Workbook is a follow-on to the little rule book. So the rule book is like, when I wrote that, it was like a Strunk and White for arguments, basically. You readers will know the Elements of Style by Strunk and White, which is a wonderful classic now, little book about how to write everything from, like, where to put apostrophes and possessives to sentence structure. And it was a beautiful little thing. So when I wrote that, it's a long time ago now, I was trying to do the same thing for arguments, a pithy, short, there weren't exercises. It was just a rule book or a kind of inspiration book, like, or a chat book like that. But it's a teaching book at the same time. It's mostly used in universities. So I would teach with it and have exercise at all. But I didn't think to write it a full textbook with it. But then this wonderful young professor who became my colleague and co-author for the workbook approached me, and he had developed these teaching materials to go along with it and said, well, why don't we do a textbook that uses the rulebook sections as the text, but then has all these exercises with a lot of guidance on how to do the exercises and the model answers, like you pointed out. I said, fabulous, let's do that. So it's really to David's credit that the book came out with that really great practical depth to it. So that's so it's intended as a, I love that you're using it the way you're using it, but basically it was intended as a textbook for a critical thinking class. So, and it is widely used for that, which we're very pleased about. The Questions book is also, well, it's kind of in between. It has some exercises, but it really is intended to highlight the importance of questions and intrigue and inspire people in the kind of way that I guess you're getting the sense that's how I operate. You know, it's not lecturing to people about it's important to ask questions. It's saying, "Huh, how about this?" and really bringing people into the process of questioning, pointing out how we do it all the time anyway, talking about some of the varieties of questioning, so it isn't just critical questioning, but expansive questions and philosophical questions, and also the way in which, as you pointed out also, questions can be abused, and how do you deal with that? So it's a range of practical skills, a short little approachable book like that. And we're hoping it you know, also will have classroom use, and we'll also have popular readers. I would love to see it, and whenever I go to airport, well, nobody goes to airports at the moment, but, you know, when generally going to airports, stop in the bookstores, you know, they're usually used bookstores. I love to see if there's ever any of my little books in there. That to me is a kind of success. I'd like people to pick them up and read them on airplanes. If that happened more often, we'd have a different world, I think.
I think so. You know, I have some other questions, especially one that your questions book prompted me to ask. But as promised, we will open the phone lines now. So as we wait for callers to call in with, I want to say that the questions book made me think about creative questions. So here's one for you. If you were interviewing yourself, what would you ask Anthony Weston?
Oh, I don't know. What would be your favorite question, maybe? What? So I guess my answer would be, well, there are lots of them, but there's one in the book, many in the book I especially like, but one I would mention, which is a little story about Carl Sagan. So he was addressing the question, what's the recipe for apple pie? How do you make an apple pie from scratch, was the question. So, you know, normally around here at my house, my kids all like cooking. So we said, oh, well, you know, you need some apples and cinnamon and sugar and all. Sagan says, well, all right, you're making apple pie from scratch. Well, that means from nothing, right? So how do you make anything from nothing? First, you have to have a universe, right? Well, like, where does the apples come from? Where does the rain come from? The soil, the cinnamon, the spices, the yeast. Well, there's no yeast, but the butter, everything. Where does the farmer come from? Ultimately you have to make a universe, and then the universe has quasars and pulsars and supernova, and eventually after a couple of generations of suns, you have a planet that coalesces, and then after, you know. And so I love that, you know. I mean, it doesn't help you make a pie, but it does help you see the world in a really different way. It's a wonderful, wonderful way of taking that question and just go, well, there are more possibilities in questions than, I mean, you might think, well, what could be more mundane than the question of how do you make an apple pie from scratch? But in Sagan's hands, it's like all of a sudden the whole universe lights up. So that's what I asked myself.
Okay.
And that's how it answers.
That's good. I think we have a couple callers, so let's take the first call. Welcome to Thinking Clearly, caller.
Hi, thank you. My name's Rebecca, and I really enjoy this show. I got a BA in Religious Studies from Humboldt State University, and I just love how this show stimulates all of those things. And earlier you were discussing the distinction between the theory of music and, like, the joy of music. And in religious studies, when we looked at it academically, I had a professor make this distinction that's always stayed with me. And he said, what is religion is not a religious question. What is the best way to live is a religious question. So I think it's the same. Like, what is music is not a musical question. It's theory. Versus, you know, what is music? The joy. So that really struck me. And then the whole thing with fake news, I think if someone is trained to think critically, the idea that there's fake news depends on the fact that people blindly accept what they would hear from someone. And that's not even relevant. There's no fake news because we're cross-referencing it. We are checking, you know, our sources and all of that. If you're critically thinking, this is just saying it's fake news because you cross-reference it and everything. So I just love the show, you guys. Thank you so much.
It does get tricky, I think I'd say, is that this attitude that we were talking about before, I think this is a rather subtle thing in a way. Maybe a way to start talking about it is to think about Wikipedia, because one place that it comes up is that if you're reading a Wikipedia article, there usually are, if the article has got some distortion in it or some problem, where a relatively, you know, they all, everything could be better, right? But something significant. Sometimes it's a very, there are clues and cues, but they're very subtle, and you have to read carefully and go, you know, the tone of a sentence or the way in which something is said or something else isn't said or something like that. And then sources. Well, so how do you evaluate whether a source is any good? There are lots of sources out there, right? You can probably find a plausible sounding citation for just about anything. But how do you know? And it isn't either or, you know, it's not absolutely crystal clear whether a source is good or not. So you have to develop a nose for it to some extent. So I guess on one level, the kind of thing that often gets called fake news that are just made up crap, but you know, that's relatively easy, and I agree with you about that. But I think the more subtle and tricky stuff is the stuff where you have to have the nose, and that takes some work, and it's not infallible, and it takes time and you know, some care. So I think that the whole thing is more of a struggle and ongoing task.
But to monitor our social media platforms so they don't tell us something fake, it's like, you know what, just give us information, we're going to weed through it. But not everyone is critically thinking and has those tools, so I guess it's like we don't want to feed the masses something they might believe.
I think we have a number of other callers, so let's go to the next call. Welcome to Thinking Clearly, caller.
Hi, thank you. I had a math requirement in college, and they sent me to the philosophy department, and I took a logics class, and it fulfilled my math requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And the next commentary I had to make was, I was a philosophy major when I was a freshman, and I had too many parties to go to, and I had too much beer to drink, and I regret that I changed my major to another double major, but I wish that I had stuck with philosophy. Just listening to your guest talk today made me realize that I should have stuck with it, because it was and is to this day my passion.
Well, it's never too late. That's what I'd say. I mean, you know, it's still there. And there's, I mean, even if you wanted to do a more traditional academic thing, online courses and all, but there's lots of books and lots of blogs and lots of things, lots of places to pursue philosophy. So I'd say, you know, very all kinds of forms of that as well. So I'd say go for it. Keep doing it. Go back to it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I agree completely with her. If I had it all to do over again, I would double major, the first major being philosophy, no matter what the second major is. I think we have another caller on the line, so let's take the call. Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello, caller.
Yes, this has to do with formal logic and Wikipedia. I've gone to Wikipedia to look for a definition, but it's so complicated. I'm wondering if you can give me a thumbnail definition of the law of the excluded middle.
Pop quiz time.
That's great.
Well, you can do it in formal terms, but essentially you're relating three categories by how to say this without symbols. So you're relating the first category and the last category by relating them both to the middle category, like a transitional category. But eventually you drop that, and so you can go right from the first to the last. I don't know if that's helpful or not. Do you know about Venn diagrams?
Well, I was going to ask you, has this to do with syllogisms?
Yeah, absolutely, right. All A or B, no B or C.
It's a simple syllogism. It just has the first, second terms and the conclusion.
Right. So that would be the classic would be like A, B, and C. So no A or B, let's say, all B or C, what can you infer from that? So the B drops out, and you get a conclusion that relates A and C. So that's the general. There are different ways that can go, but the general idea is that you're using the middle term to get you from the... to a, to discern the relationship between the first and the third terms by looking at the by using temporarily the middle term.
Not bad for a radio pop quiz.
Caller, does that answer your question?
Well, I first came across this term in Lytton Strachey's essay on Florence Nightingale, and I was wondering, all this time I've been wondering exactly what it referred to.
Well, we're getting close to the top of the hour, so very quickly, I want to ask you a little bit about Hartsmill Eco Village, because that seems to be your passion. You retired there. You combined it with environmental studies, your interest in that. So what really led, and this is going to be we need a short answer to what I'm asking is probably a long question, but what led to your passion for and your vision to develop this agrarian intentional community?
Well, it goes back to the asking of questions, I guess. We were talking about asking the question, how could things be different? How could things be radically better? And but that doesn't, some philosophers, actually many philosophers, have thought you could figure that out as a conceptual project, you know, and lay out a blueprint for utopia. But more realistically, it's probably takes some experimenting, you know, trying some different ways to live. We probably could improve on the ways we live at present, right? At least for some of us. So this is a project like that, is an attempt to say, well, given our particularly the environmental concerns and social concerns and the scale of society and, you know, a number of things like that, that many of us would like to live in a different way. Let's try one, you know. So we're trying with a group of folks who, broadly speaking, share ecological values and the idea of a rather more radical form of neighborliness and living on the land, growing some of our own food, providing some of our for ourselves and taking care of each other. We're working on that as a project, trying to build it, trying to stay open about how it might go and how we might eventually set things up. Then you get down to really concrete things like, you know, will the county allow us to drill our own wells, and how deep do they have to be, and how far away from each other, and what about this, and what about that? So it's interesting on a lot of levels. But we're trying to imagine a better world and build a prototype.
Experiential learning rather than theoretical, and you're talking to the right people, because there's a lot of that going on in our area. So thank you very much, Anthony Weston, for being a wonderful guest and sharing your knowledge with us. I'm going to post some of the links on our Facebook page to your work and your books. And I want to thank our engineer, Daryl Lee. And as always, thank you, Julia. And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.
Thank you, guys. Think for yourself, people. It's your first and your last chance.